In the world of athletics, there's no greater reward than winning an Olympic gold medal. The gold medal is the reward that separates you from every other competitor in the sport. Take it from someone who's won the gold medal 23 times, Michael Phelps, 23 gold medals. He says this, "If you want to be the best, you have to do things other people aren't willing to do." I can't help but share a proud dad story of the time my son won his big reward in basketball. And we found out just how big it was for him when we were having a summer trip out to Michigan. His name was Caden. And we said, "Caden, your responsibility is to pack your bag of things to do in the car out to Michigan. It's a 15-hour ride. Remember that, okay?" So we said, "Okay." So he gets packed. We get all packed. We get in the car. We say, "Okay, so what'd you pack?" And he opens up his little rocket ship suitcase, and he pulls out one Lego picture book and his basketball trophy. And that's it. I said, "Caden, this is a 15-hour ride. Like, if you look at that Lego book for 30 minutes, you're going to stare at your trophy for 14 and a half hours?" We couldn't quite get it. But as he explained, the reason he wanted to bring his trophy was because he was so proud of it, and he was so proud to show his grandparents out of Michigan. This is something that he really worked for, that he really achieved. The trophy is about this big. It's got this bright orange basketball on top. But here's the thing about the trophy. At the bottom of it, etched in super plain, boring letters, is not his name or any of his statistics. It's just the words, "Miller Place School District Student Basketball 2014. You see, this is a participation trophy. Are you all familiar with that, a participation trophy? And some of us really kind of have a little bit of angst or animosity towards participation trophies. I'm one of those. I think sometimes, you know, let the kids who really excel in their sports get rewarded for it. Nothing wrong with that, right? I mean, if you really work hard, if you really put in the time to be able to have something that shows that you've achieved that much, can be a great thing. I think, generally speaking, we tend to look at participation trophies as more of a gift than a reward. Like, if you show up and you've got a jersey on, here's your trophy. You know, you probably don't even have to wear a jersey to get the trophy. Like, you won't be allowed in the picture, but you can still get the participation trophy. But on the other hand, I think of Caden. I think of just how proud he was to show his grandparents that trophy. It's not because he earned it or he won it or he did any special accomplishments to get it. It's the fact that when he was in second grade, he got to go onto the floor like the big boys, to dribble and pass, to wear his red and white jersey. To him, that was the most meaningful thing. He was so happy for that experience that he didn't care about his rank on the team. Well, this may seem like kind of a trite little argument or a little concept to think about. Maybe it seems meaningless, in fact, but nonetheless, I think this story kind of exposes a tendency of all of our human hearts at some point. Because it feels like there's more and more pressure these days to win at everything. There's pressure all around you. You gotta win at life. Have you guys heard that or seen it, you know, on social media or in a hashtag or something, to win at life? Work and school, social status, our relationships. You name it, we have often unwillingly found ourselves in the midst of competition with others, thinking that there's some reward to being the best at these things. And the trouble is, this need to succeed leaves us vulnerable to a very dangerous pattern of thought. So today I want to talk about a kind of hidden danger in all the things that we compete with others in, what we're risking, and how to avoid that. There's a parable that Jesus once told, it's recorded in the Gospel of Matthew, that really cuts right to the heart of the problem of what we're talking about today. And I'd love to explore that with you today. If you want to take out a Bible in front of you, I don't have words up on the screen, so you might want to follow along. It's Matthew chapter 20. We're going to be looking at verses 1 through 16. It's on page 1533, and the Bible's in front of you, if that helps. And through this, the Lord is going to show us a solution that lets us become people that are more at peace with ourselves, more at peace with relationships and the people around us, whether they're people that we like or not. So let's go ahead and read this together. Matthew chapter 20. I'm going to just read verses 1 through 9 and stop, and then we'll catch up a bit. But it's page 1533. And this is Jesus speaking, telling the story. He says, "For the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire workers for his vineyard. He agreed to pay them a denarius for the day and sent them into his vineyard. About 9 in the morning, he went out and saw others standing in the marketplace doing nothing. He told them, 'You also go and work in my vineyard, and I will pay you whatever is right.' So they went. He went out again about noon and about 3 in the afternoon and did the same thing. About 5 in the afternoon, he went out and found still others standing around. He asked them, 'Why have you been standing here all day doing nothing?' 'Because no one has hired us,' they answered. He said to them, 'You also go and work in my vineyard.' When evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his foreman, 'Call the workers and pay them their wages, beginning with the last ones hired and going on to the first.' The workers who were hired about 5 in the afternoon came and each received a denarius." So let's just stop here for a second. Before going any further, just we've got to keep in mind why Jesus is telling this parable. This is how he starts almost all of his parables, is describing the kingdom of heaven, painting a picture of the kingdom of heaven. If you've been attending Three Village Church for a while, you've probably heard the kingdom of heaven described with the phrase, "already, not yet." Have you heard that? Hope that sounds familiar. And what it refers to is that we look at God as he already rules over his natural creation. He already rules in the hearts of the people who love him and follow him, but his full rule is not yet complete. And we wait for that day. But in the meantime, evil is still pervasive, and terrible things still happen to terrific people. But we are invited to not only imagine what heaven might be like, we're invited to live as if God is already in control. So when Jesus tells parables about the kingdom of heaven, it's inviting us to live as if God was already ruling our earth. So from the start of this story, as we consider the kingdom of heaven, it's off to a pretty good start. We've got a landowner who doesn't just own a massive vineyard, but apparently he's super, super generous. The first group he hires starts to work at 6 a.m., and they agree to work for a denarius. A denarius was a Roman coin. It was equal to a day's pay. So when you hear denarius, just think a day's pay. It was actually a pretty good day's pay. One historian I read said a Roman soldier would receive an annual salary of about 300 denarius. So one denarius is pretty good day's pay. So when he hires these guys at 6 a.m. and they agree to work for a denarius, they're getting a pretty good deal. But after a couple hours, the landowner goes back to the marketplace. In fact, he goes back several times. He keeps going back all the way up until 5 p.m. The workday ends at 6. And he keeps going back. Even at 5 p.m., he's still hiring people in the marketplace. And the marketplace back then was kind of a town center for all things business related. So it's not just where things are bought or sold and traded, but it's also where you would go and stand around looking for work. And I'm really struck by this group who comes to work at 5 p.m. Can you imagine coming to work at 5 p.m. if the day ends at 6? I mean, at that point of the day, I would think that one has to be pretty desperate for work. You'll take whatever you can get. You'll do whatever you have to do. You're not going to walk away with much, maybe a couple bucks, maybe less. Back in first century Roman-ruled Israel, where this takes place, working in the vineyard could have meant a couple different things. It could have been picking the grapes off the trees. It could have been loading them in baskets or bringing them to the wine press. It could have been crushing the grapes with your feet. But either way, it was pretty hard manual labor. And with all the work to be done, the day worker was nothing more than just an able body to keep this agrarian machine going. Wine was an enormous industry in Israel in that time. It was their number one export, huge moneymaker, a big part of their economy. So these later groups of workers who come at 5 p.m. are really at the mercy of the landowner. He can treat them however he wants. If he wants to pay them terrible, what are they going to do? There's no union they could go to and file a complaint. You know, it's not like today where you could just quit your job and go work for another. The story even tells us they're standing around all day in the marketplace and no one's hired them. So they are going to take whatever they can get. The good news is things are about to work out in their favor. When the day ends at 6 p.m., the landowner tells his manager, okay, let's bring everyone in and pay them what they earned. And this was the custom back then. You would actually take the last people who came to work, you would pay them first, and the first people, you would pay them last. So that's the custom of how pay was handed out. There was no paychecks. There's no direct deposit. At the end of every day, you got to leave with cold, hard cash. So these later workers, some who worked only one single hour, are probably expecting really little. Again, a couple bucks, not much. Can you imagine the surprise when they stand up to go get their pay and they get a full day's wage? Can you imagine what that might have felt like? If you were that worker, what does that make you think of this landowner? I think I'd want to work for him again. I think whatever kind of enterprise he's got going here, I'd want to work for him again. The point that Jesus is telling is this. In the kingdom of heaven, God is super generous. He gives all to everyone. God's kingdom is not just for the gold medalists of Christianity, as if there were such a thing, which there's not. It's open to anyone who wants to come and be a part of it. And this is not necessarily just an isolated teaching from Jesus. This is not just one little teaching among all these things he said. This is very consistent with what he's been saying all along. Just before this, as he's speaking to his disciples, he lifts up children as models for the kingdom of heaven. He says to prostitutes and tax collectors, even you guys have a better chance of getting in than the Pharisees, the religious people, the pastors and priests of their day. God's kingdom is really more of a gift than a reward. It's given to those, it's not given to the people who have achieved perfection in life, but to anybody who wants to be a part of God's kingdom. Not only does God fulfill his promises to those who trust in him, in this case, that'd be the workers hired first, but he even awards the full benefit of his kingdom to those who have made very little effort. So as we look at this kind of generosity, you kind of start to think, well, how is this received among the others? I bet this is received with, wow, everyone probably loves this, right? Let's keep reading. I'm going to pick up in verse 10 now, right where we left off. So when those came who were hired first, they expected to receive more. But each one of them also received a denarius. When they received it, they began to grumble against the landowner. Those who were hired last worked only 1 hour, they said, and you've made them equal to us who have borne the burden of the work and the heat of the day. But he answered one of them, I'm not being unfair to you, friend. Didn't you agree to work for a denarius? Take your pay and go. I want to give the one who was hired last the same as I gave you. Don't I have the right to do what I want with my own money? Or are you envious because I'm generous? Now we've got a problem. The first workers, who were given everything that they were promised by the landowners, they still aren't happy about it. They grumbled against the landowner. Just 12 hours ago, when they told that they were going to get a denarius, they were really happy with it. So what's changed since then? Why are they suddenly grumbling about receiving what they were told they'd get? I think the key to discovering the problem that Jesus is talking about with this parallel is right here in verse 12. The workers say, "You have made them equal to us who have borne the burden of the work and the heat of the day." In other words, hey, we worked for our reward. They didn't. They shouldn't have been rewarded our reward. Now, on the one hand, this seems like a fair thing to think, doesn't it? I mean, if you put in more work, if you sacrifice more, you get paid more. That seems to make sense, right? That's not that revolutionary of a thought. Is that really bad? It sounds like a reasonable response. Is there anything wrong with that? It seems so. And there are two clues that tip us off that there's something wrong with the way that these first workers are acting. Here's the first clue. Let me first admit, Josh mentioned I'm a seminary student. Greek is not my strong point. I thought it might be. It's not. So I'm not one to stand up here and preach Greek too much. But when I first read this passage in the original Greek, there's something that jumped right off the page at me. It's in verse 13. When the workers first start to grumble against the landowner, his response is, "I'm not being unfair to you, friend." It's that word friend. The word friend in Greek is philos. It's used over 70 times in the New Testament. It's always, it's translated as beloved, and it's always used as a term of endearment, but not here. Here, he's actually using a different word for friend called hetari. Hetari means companion or friend. And you say, okay, well, so what? He uses one word for friend instead of another word for friend. What's the difference? As you start analyzing the text, you start looking at why an author used a certain word. And this word, hetari, is only used three times in the entire New Testament, only by Matthew. This is one of them. Okay, so example number one is the landowner saying to the first worker, "I'm not being unfair to you, friend." Example number two comes a couple chapters later in a parable where a man who's not wearing the right wedding clothes is called friend and then thrown out in the street. That's example number two. You know what the third example of the use of this word hetari is? The third example is in the Garden of Gethsemane. When Judas comes with a gang of people carrying torches and spears to take Jesus away, you know what Jesus says to him? "Do what you've come to do, friend." Hetari. So is he using the word friend? Yes. But rather than being a very kind of friendly use of the word friend, this has more of a connotation of something along the lines of, "I thought we were friends. I thought we understood each other. I thought I could count on you." That's more of how the word friend here is used. So that's our first clue that there's something wrong with the behavior of these first workers. The second clue is a little more clear cut. Verse 15, the landowner says, "Well, don't I have the right to do what I want with my own money? Or are you envious because I'm generous?" In the original Greek, what he's actually asking is, "Or is your eye evil because I'm generous?" Have you ever heard the expression "giving the evil eye"? You give someone the evil eye. Have you guys heard that? It's a look like this. You know, I can't do it well. It's a look that you wish harm on someone else. This was a phrase used widely in the ancient Mediterranean world. It's still used today in some religions, and it carries the idea of putting a curse on someone, wishing them harm. And it goes even deeper than that, this concept of the evil eye. Another expression, have you heard this? "The eyes are the window into the soul." Have you heard that? Yeah. People can often tell honesty from dishonesty in someone just by looking at their eyes. We say, you know, "I could see it in her eyes and I knew she meant it." or I took one look in his eyes and knew I didn't want to do business with that guy. And Jesus uses this very same language in the Sermon on the Mount back in Matthew chapter 6. This is what he says. The eye is the lamp of the body. If your eye is healthy, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eyes are unhealthy, your whole body will be full of darkness. If the light within you is darkness, how great is that darkness? In other words, if our eye, if our true intentions are to react negatively when somebody else gets something good, then there's a problem within our very own heart. And the problem here is what we call envy. Envy. A lot of us tend to sometimes just lump in jealousy and envy as kind of the same thing, but it's not exactly the same thing, especially not here. Just to make the distinction, let's say this. Jealousy, we'll call it wanting what somebody else has. Envy is wishing that they never had it to begin with. So if jealousy is looking at somebody else and wanting what they have, envy is looking at them and wishing they never had it to begin with. One source that I read defined it this way. I thought this was really good. Envy is the displeasure at the assets or success of another and a malevolent wish to see the envy one deprived of what he has. A malevolent wish to see the envied one deprived of what he has. Billy Graham said that the trouble with envy is that the envious man feels that other people's fortune is his misfortune, that their success is his failure, and that their blessing is his curse. Christian tradition calls envy one of the seven deadly sins, and it's not because there's a greater consequence for deadly sins. It's because envy is something that has the potential to kill your spiritual development, to ruin your relationship with God. Envy kills you. Harboring envy can block you from seeing God's blessings in your life because all you're doing is looking at other people. You're so focused on what they have. You know, it's usually when we're feeling down about ourselves that envy is the biggest threat. When we see other people winning at life, having a great life, well, we're suffering. That's a time where envy can come in. It's an easy but dangerous response to make ourselves feel better by bringing them down to our level or below our level. Oh, that guy is such a jerk. I can't believe he got that. He doesn't deserve that. She doesn't deserve that. That's envy. Envy tempts us with the promise of feeling better, but it never, ever delivers on that promise. It promises you that it'll make you feel better, but it never delivers on that promise. Have you all heard of a play called Amadeus? It was from the late 1970s. It actually won the Tony Award for the best play in 1981. It's a fictionalized portrayal of the famous composer Wolfgang Mozart and his rival Antonio Salieri. So in the play, Salieri first hears Mozart's music, and he's totally enthralled with it. He said, "This is so beautiful. This is the work of a genius. I've got to meet this guy." So he does everything he can to go and meet Mozart. Now, Salieri is a composer himself, but nothing anywhere close to the level that Mozart is. So he's so excited to meet Mozart and to see this genius behind the music. But when he meets him, he discovers that the man Mozart is nothing like the beauty in his music. When they first meet, Mozart is crawling around on his hands and knees, cursing at his future wife. This goes on, and as Salieri considers it more, he can't believe, he can't come to terms with the fact that God would give that kind of a guy such an immense talent. Why not me? Why him and not me? In the play, as he goes further and further through this, he ends up renouncing God completely. And he makes it his life mission. He vows to destroy Mozart. He sets out to smear Mozart's reputation. Finally, he attempts to poison Mozart with arsenic. And to make sure that he's remembered for something, he writes a note of confession and attempts suicide. He survives the suicide, and he lives out the rest of his days wallowing in his mediocrity, his sorrow, and his bitter, bitter envy. Envy kills you. Envy tempts us with the promise of feeling better, but never delivers. Envy is like drinking poison and expecting the other person to die from it. That's envy. Envy kills you. It'll ruin your relationship with others. It'll ruin your relationship with yourself and with God. And at this point, we may be tempted to think, okay, well, who is Jesus telling this to? Who is this teaching for? You know, maybe this is for the Pharisees or for the real wicked people of his day. But if you look back at verse 1 and you see that this parable starts with the word for, so it's a continuation of what Jesus just said. The last sentence he said, "What many are first will be last, and many who are last will be first." He's talking to Peter. This comes right at the time when Peter comes up to him and says, "Lord, we've left everything for you. What will there be in the kingdom for us? If I sacrifice everything, if I leave everything, what will my reward be?" So when Jesus tells this parable, he's not talking to the Pharisees, his usual foe. He's not talking to the down and outs, the criminals or derelicts of society. He's telling this story to one of his best and closest friends, one of his most devout followers. Now, if Jesus is this upfront with Peter, then this is something that all of us really need to pay attention to. So let's just pause for a moment and just ask ourselves, have we envied someone? Have we wished that they didn't have what they have? Have we wished that they had as hard of a time at life as we have? Have we maybe even wished harm on someone? Have we envied? I want to pause for a moment and just let you consider that. I want to tell you about a time recently when I had to struggle with this envy. Oh, I'd like to sit down. So Josh mentioned earlier, and I mentioned I'm a student at seminary. And this past spring semester, I took 3 classes, plus an internship at a local church. And it was really tough, not just academically, but even just in life. As the semester went on, I found myself just getting more grumpy. I would argue with Michelle a little bit more. I'd be just a little more kind of short or curt with the kids. And that really started weighing heavy on me. And I got really close with a good friend of mine up there who's also a student. His name is Anthony. And Anthony's just an awesome guy. This big, burly dude from Colorado. Loves the outdoors. He's got a fantastic wife, 2 really cool kids, and everything comes easy for Anthony. Everything. And it drives me nuts. Here I was taking my 3 classes, going crazy, asking my teachers for, my professors for extensions, rushing to get things done on time, and always just like, oh, I've got to do this, and I've got to do this, and oh, when is life just going to let up? That was with 3 classes plus a church internship. Anthony was taking 6 classes plus a counseling internship, way more intense than what I was doing. And every day after class, I'm in the library just pounding myself into this stuff. Come on, you got to get this, you got to get this. Where's Anthony? Oh, he's out hiking Mount Monadnock today. What? Finally, reading week comes. Reading week is a time where there's no classes, there's no new assignments. The professors just give you 1 week to catch up on all that reading they've been throwing at you the whole semester. So I'm like, finally, the whole reading week. 8 o'clock a.m. comes, I'm in the library with my coffee, going nuts, just pouring over this stuff. Like, okay, I've got to get this, I've got to get this. Go away, kids, I don't have time. Don't get you, I've got to get this. Where's Anthony? Oh, he took his kids to Six Flags today. You kidding me? I started having the hardest time, like, just getting along with my kids. I was just always short-tempered. Where's Anthony? Oh, he took his kids out sailing today. Like, what? What's, does this guy, like, do any work? Yeah, he gets straight A's all the time. Like, this is killing me. How is this possible? And that right there is where I started to envy Anthony. I started to say, man, not just I wish what he had, but I wish that just for a minute he could feel what it's like to have this much trouble with school. I wish that he could feel what it's like to come home and just not really be getting along with my wife because I'm so burdened with the other stuff. I wish that he would come home and just and have these kind of troubles with his kids. That is the beginning of envy. That right there was the root of envy. And as the semester went on, it got harder and harder and harder. So finally one day, Anthony and I hang out a lot. So I'm at his apartment one night, and I flat out asked him. I said, I have two questions for you. Number one, how do you do this? Like, how do you get straight A's? How do you write a 10-page paper in 3 hours? And he gave me an answer that was totally unhelpful. He's like, I don't know. It's just something I do. It just comes naturally. Yeah, great. Thanks, Anthony. The second question was a little bit deeper. I said, every time I see you around campus, you're not stressed. You've got a smile on your face. You're going somewhere. You're having a good time. I'm going crazy. And you're doing twice the work I am, better than I am, and you're way happier. How do you do that? And this is where he really helped. He said, when I came here, he said a lot more than this, but I'll condense it down to this. He said, when I came here, I knew that I had to put my family first. I knew that my faith, my identity in Christ, who I was, had to come before school, before grades, before the internship. And anytime I start feeling stressed about a paper that's coming up, I force myself to first go spend time with my kids. I force myself to go back to God's word. I force myself to get in prayer. I got to get my head right before I can do any of that. That one conversation just started to change things. But as the semester wore on, and I considered Anthony and the way that he was with his school, with his family, with his life, I started thinking about the things in my life. I said, man, I have a beautiful and capable and very talented wife who really cares deeply for me. I've got 3 great kids who actually want to spend time with their dad. I have the privilege of coming to one of the most premier Christian institutions in the world and studying under some of the best people who have put in years and years and years to come and teach people like me. Beyond that, I have breath. I have legs. There's so many blessings. And as I started to consider all these things, rather than envying Anthony, I finally started to feel content. I finally started to feel content. And that's when it hit me. Envy kills you. Contentment fills you. Envy kills you. Contentment fills you. Fills you with gratitude. Fills you with love. Fills you with the ability to be okay with your life. To be okay with your circumstances. And contentment goes way deeper than just material things that you have or temporal things and relationships in life. It goes way deeper than that. The more I started studying this passage, the more I realized that God doesn't just love you and me by giving us nice things or nice experiences in life. That's part of it. But the real crux of the matter is that God loves you and me by giving his son. The cross cost Jesus his life, but it costs us nothing for God to redeem us like that. That is a gift, not a reward. We don't earn it. We can't earn it. We can only receive it. I think it's one of the greatest things about this gift. It's like, yeah, I want that gift. What do I have to do to get it? In order to get the gift, you have to receive it. Okay. That's it. You have to receive it. And when we see that he offers the same redemption to us that he offers to everyone else, there's no way to be envious about that. We can't be envious about it if God is choosing to give us the gift, just like others. The kingdom of heaven is a gift. It's not a reward. And I believe that this parable shows us that. In verse 15, this is how it ends. The landowner says, I want to give the one who was hired last the same as I gave you. Don't I have the right to do what I want with my own money? We can be content to know that God gave himself up for you, that he welcomes you fully into his kingdom, that you get every benefit of his kingdom, regardless of how much effort you put in. Only have to receive it. You can't deserve it, can't earn it. You can only receive it. None of us have any claim to a gold medal or even so much as a little gold star in the kingdom. But God gives all of his generosity to us through Christ. Someone who got this really well was the Apostle Paul. And I want to end with a quote from him from Philippians chapter 4. Paul says, "For I have learned to be content, whatever the circumstances. I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret of being content in any and all situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. I can do all this through him who gives me strength." I'd love to close by praying for you all. Will you pray with me? Dear God, what wonderful gifts you have in store for those who love you. God, as we go through life, we just pray for the strength to not compare ourselves with others, to not stew in our want for what they have, to not be envious and wish they didn't have it at all, but God, that we would be content with the blessings you give us. God, we are most grateful for the biggest blessing we could possibly get, and that is you, giving yourself up in death so that you could be with us forever. God, we can't wait for that day. We thank you for Jesus, for the price he paid on the cross. And it's in his name we pray, for his glory, for his kingdom, his honor, his sake. Amen.